Hello, and welcome to the second episode of The Melting Pot here at St. Ignatius High School. I'm Everett Allen Hood, and today we have Dr. Richardson Phillips as our second guest. We hope whoever turns into this podcast enjoys. So to start off, Dr. Richardson Phillips, could you give us a little bit of a self-introduction?
Sure. I'm Deborah Richardson Phillips, and certainly I have the pleasure of serving as your Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion here at St. Ignatius High School. I've been here about a year and a half. And it's been a fantastic experience thus far. My background is somewhat interesting and non-traditional, I think, for someone who kind of finds him or herself in this role. So my undergraduate degree is in political science and sociology, primarily because I intended to go to law school. And that was quite the experience, I must say. I actually ended up not going because of an experience I had while I was taking the law school admissions test, and decided that that was not the direction for me, as a result of some comments that the proctor made to me around applying. And basically what she said to me in that moment was, we were talking about, while we were taking the exam, they told us that we could park along the building. And as we were taking the exam, the security came and said, hey, you know, you need to move your cars or we're going to tow them. So probably about 20 people got up to move their cars from around the building. Well, I didn't score as well as I would have liked the first time, so I went back to take it again. And when I went to take it the second time, I was sitting next to a woman, and the lady said, oh, I remember you. You were here taking the exam before. And I said, oh, yeah, my car was, you know, parked along the building. And the proctor was walking up and down the aisle. And she said, oh, well, how did you score the first time? And I told her. And she said, oh, well, you wasted money taking it the second time because we take black students with lower scores. And I was stunned. And immediately I said, you know, I went home and told to my parents, I don't want to go to law school. They don't even expect me to be as intelligent, right? And so I'm not interested in doing that. And so I took a very different path. I then went on to get a master's in public administration and still interested in policy, wanted to do personnel stuff around FMLA and those types of things. So I got a master's in public administration with a concentration in personnel. And then I went to, while I was in my master's program, the University of Delaware said, hey, would you like to stay and get a doctorate? And my dad, I said, I don't know. And I called my parents, and my dad said, well, do you have a job? And I was like, no, I don't. He was like, well, I think you ought to stay. So that's actually how I ended up with a doctorate degree. So I stayed, and my PhD is in human development, and I have a specialization in family crisis. And that too was kind of unexpected. I had a friend visiting, and we were horseback riding. She twisted her knee, and we found ourselves in the emergency room. And while we were there, there was a woman on a gurney on the other side of a curtain who obviously had been in an abusive relationship. And I thought that the nurse was pretty rude. And I kind of thought, you know what, she's being re-victimized. So it bothered me so much that after we left the hospital a couple of days later, I called back to the hospital to file a complaint. And they said, hey, do you know how domestic violence works? And I said, no, I don't. And they said, we'd love to talk to you about it. You might be interested in being a patient advocate. So I found myself back in the same emergency room talking to some administrators. And I ended up being an advocate at the hospital for women who came in for domestic violence. And then they asked me to work at a domestic violence center. And while I was there, one day, the court advocate couldn't go. And they said, hey, would you mind accompanying this woman to court? And I said, hey, I'm not an attorney. Like, I don't know. And I actually went. And Everett, what I found so very interesting, and this really was my introduction to DEI work, was I was there. And I watched woman after woman go before male judges who had no understanding of domestic violence and the cycle of violence, who really kind of lashed out at these women for being in abusive relationships. And I also began in that moment to notice racial differences around how the women were treated. So Latino and African American women were treated one way, and white women were treated differently. And that kind of sparked my interest. And I began in that moment to say, it's cultural. Like, this has nothing to do with the woman, right? Some of the nuances that you were experiencing around what's happening in court and a woman's willingness to move forward through the legal system has more to do with culture than it actually does with whether or not she's a good mom. And that kind of sparked my whole interest. And from that point on, I've been doing DEI work, graduated from University of Delaware, and I started my career at a faith-based institution. So it's really nice to be at the back end of my career. I hope not the end, but the back end of it, as a faculty member at Messiah College, a Christian college right outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So I was a faculty member and then an associate dean of multicultural faith there. And then I worked at Case Western doing diversity work. I was their director of multicultural affairs. I worked with students and I loved students. But then I woke up one day and I said, I'm working really hard here. Like, students impact the culture in the moment, but faculty and staff, leadership, that's who changes culture. So I decided to get a certification in human resources so that I could work on that side of the house. And from there, I did some consulting work for First Energy, a utility company in the area. I was their chief diversity consultant there. And then I was blessed enough to have someone reach out and tell me about this job. And so here I am. So it's really kind of this non-traditional path to doing this work. I don't have a background in it. It's something I learned along the way through life experience and kind of commitment to doing it, which is why I know it can be done. Because this, I don't have a degree in this, right? And so with the right commitment, people can do this work. So that's kind of who I am. I landed here.
I got a lot from that. it goes to show how college is not the end all be all, especially with your story. And going back to the court case where you said it was your first experience of really getting introduced to DEI.
Mm-hmm.
We're reading Just Mercy in AP English language, and I can easily go back to that book and see how I definitely agree that the law heads and whatnot do have a disconnect with the people they work with and those on trial, because they're so disconnected from the fact of their age, their background, their wealth, their mental problems, any abuse they've had in the past, even the race. It's very baffling how often our judicial system can really really screw up because we're not aware, the judges are not aware of who they're prosecuting.
There's that, you know, and there's I think historically been a disconnect for people of color in the criminal justice system, and that's part of the challenge, right? There's not a lot of trust for the system. There's not a sense that it is equitable, you know, and you find that when you look at how the percentage of people of color, in particular African-American males, who are incarcerated, and the amount of time often that they receive for crimes that are very similar to those from dominant culture who get less, you know, less time and certainly resources. Sometimes that's primarily kind of for some folks. That's why they are unable to really secure the type of representation they should get. So they often end up with public defenders. And I know, like, going back to my graduate domestic violence days, like, one of the things I noticed when I was sitting in that courtroom is, you know, often, you know, someone with resources, right? And so when you think about kind of the work I do, you have to think about intersection, right? And so sometimes it is race, but sometimes it is race, and it is socioeconomics, and it is education. Sometimes it's religion, sometimes it's ability, right? And so, you know, thinking about this work from just a race or gender perspective is a really archaic way of thinking about that, because it is so much broader than that. But what I found in those cases is if a woman came in and she was poor, I don't care what color she was, she had a difficult time at the hospital, right? So if I don't have any resources and I go into a hospital and let's say I you know, have a bruise on my cheek and I'm poor, the first thing they assume is that I'm in an abusive relationship, right? And then they want to involve the police and they want to involve child protective services. And that's often why women don't want to come forward, because they get re-victimized. Because now I'm here because I was abused, but now you want to take my children, right? So they often don't want to report. So they often don't even get the type of medical care they should get. The flip side of that is if I come in and I am married to a physician or an attorney or a police officer with that same bruise, they automatically assume I fell. Like they don't, not until very recently did they start saying, you know, are you in a safe home, right? And often even that is an inappropriate question, because if you and I are in a relationship and you're abusive and they ask me if I'm living in an abusive situation, what am I gonna say? I'm gonna say no, right? And so resources also play a part in that, you know, whether or not I can get great legal representation, you know, is huge. So yeah, there's historically a disconnect between, you know, people of color and the criminal justice system, and that goes back. I mean, you know, you can certainly, you know, anything that you want to review around the civil rights movement, you know, Black Panthers, and you know, just kind of it's interesting how we continue to kind of propagate that negative relationship as well. And so one of the things I'm hoping to do in this role is to bridge some of those gaps in our community, and that's one of the reasons that I took this position. Like, this is the best job I have ever had, because all I have ever genuinely wanted to do was make a difference. And while I felt like I was doing that in corporate America, the opportunity to have 1,500 young men in front of me who are formed in faith, who also understand the gravity of equity, it's overwhelming. Like every day I wake up and I'm like, God, I can't even believe I have this opportunity, because I know the type of impact that St. Ignatius alumni have in this world. And that probably sounds very cliche, but it's true.
Yeah, I was going to get to that question too, because from an outside perspective, it's a little odd that someone kind of out of your stature would choose St. Ignatius High School, because to me it just seems like an all-boys school. But then I realized what you said. It does, the product of the school, I don't want to call us products, but in a way we are, what we do outside can really impact the world, versus, but at the same time, you could have went into maybe more impoverished areas, and, now that I think about it, maybe, through St. Ignatius, the greater community, we give back to those impoverished areas far better than doing it directly, in a way.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed certainly being a college professor. I enjoyed that, and I enjoyed, you know, corporate America as much as someone can, right? But again, at the end of the day, I wanted to make a difference. And I'll be honest, when they reached out to me about this job, so that we used a consulting firm for my position, the school did. And when they reached out to me, and I said, like, you've got to be kidding. you really, come on. A high school. Now, granted, so let's put it in context. I'm not from Cleveland. And so I was recruited to come here to work at Case. So I came from central Pennsylvania. I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, about 3 hours down the road. But I left, and when I went to undergraduate school at Winston-Salem State. So I'm a proud HBCU graduate. So I went to Winston-Salem State to play basketball there. I left home at 16 to go to college, and I never lived in Ohio since I left to go to college. So I go off to go to college. I'm in Pennsylvania. I'm doing all these things and, you know, writing and, you know, just God is moving in my life and opening up doors for me. And then, you know, they call about this. So I don't really know a lot about St. Ignatius, right? So I'm like, oh my God, have I fallen that far that they would call me about a high school? Like, I'm working in corporate America. Like, they cannot. And I said to my, I told my husband, I said, you know, these recruiters reached out to me about St. Ignatius High School. And my husband said, oh yeah, you know, my husband grew up in Cleveland. So he's like, oh, that is a great school. It's got a great reputation. And he was honest. He said, you know, it doesn't have a great reputation in Black and brown communities, but that is a dynamic school. And because you are a college athlete, because your dad was in athletics and, you know, played in the NFL, you love football, they've got a great football team, you love basketball, like, that is just, like, gonna be the cat's meow for you. Like, you are gonna love this job. And I was like, dude, are you kidding? So, of course, I did my homework, and I started to kind of ask people, and several folks said, hey, you know what, like, yeah, you're not from here, you don't know that school. And I said, well, you know, if you give me a couple adjectives, like, what would you say? And they were like, Catholic, which you are not, rich, which you are not, male, which you are not, white, which you are not, and they're racist, which you don't like. So, like, why would you go? I don't even believe you're considering that. And I was like, wow. And I continued to ask and continued to ask. And there were a couple people who, you know, there was no question about the faith formation. There was no question about academic excellence. There was no question about sports. What I didn't hear a lot about was community. What I didn't hear a lot about was culture. I just kept hearing racist. And so I said to my husband, I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I need to pray about this. And then I woke up 2:30 in the morning, and I sat straight up in the bed, and I said, I'm going to do it. And he said, why? And it's interesting, you know, Everett, I'm a person that believes that if you just, if you're patient and if you pray and you allow God to work in your life, things will work out, right? So I have two children. So my son Nathan is 23 and he lives in LA. He graduated from Ohio University. And so my son is a film kid. And so he went to Ohio University. And while he was there, I was committed to allowing him to graduate from college with the least amount of debt that we could afford. And so we were really blessed to be able to allow him to get through school with his academic scholarships and all the kind of stuff he had. We, as a family, didn't have to pay a lot. So he graduated, and he didn't have any debt. And we were so thankful for that. But then I also have a daughter that's 4 years behind him. So, and my daughter's name is Monet. And Monet is now a film major at OU. That's a very interesting story, too, how two kids in the same family get into film. But I said to my husband, I said, you know, if I leave corporate America and I take this job, like, she's going to have some debt. And I don't know how I feel about that, because we gave him a good start in life. And I prayed about it. And I was like, God, if this is what you want me to do, I need this to work out. I need this to work out. And so right as I was interviewing here, my daughter was a senior in high school. She applied to OU, and she got invited to be a Cutler Scholar, which is a full ride academic scholarship. And so my husband was like, well, if she gets a full ride, like, you know, he kept saying, like, you're running out of excuses. Like, God seems to be pushing you, leading you in this direction, but you always have another reason. And she was able to secure a 4-year, you know, full ride to OU. And then the resources, the money didn't matter anymore. And so that morning when I woke up, I said, I'm going to do it. God has positioned us and has given me kind of the desires of my heart for my family. And I think, you know, it's positioning me to do what I want to do, which is make a difference. And I'm going to do it. And so, I circled back and I also bless you. God bless you. I will also say it was very interesting to me. I've been offered positions before. And no one has ever said, take a week and think about it and pray about it. They're always like, okay, let us know tomorrow, right? Because we don't want to lose the next person. We don't want to lose number two. So we can't drag this on really a long time. But the fact that when they reached out to me, they said, I'll never forget, it was like June 28th, like early in the morning, and they said, just let us know by 4th of July. If you could let us know going into the holiday. And I was like, who does that? Like, who gives somebody a whole week to think about a job? And I prayed about it and I prayed about it. And then finally I was like, you have an opportunity to be in a place where you personally can grow and you can make a difference. And every year you've got all these young men in front of you. Your faith is important, and they're here because their faith is important to them and to their families, and you cannot pass up this opportunity. And I have not regretted it one day. When other positions are available, you're stuck with me, Everett.
I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that.
Because I absolutely love it here. I love it here.
Mm-hmm. And before, I heard you say that you went to college at 16?
I did. Yeah.
So I'm a little curious about like what your adolescent years were like.
Tough. Call my mom. It was tough. It was tough, Everett. So I skipped from 5th to 7th grade. So that's how I kind of got ahead. Because I constantly stayed in trouble at school. Because I talked all the time. Not surprising, huh? I love people. I really get energy from people. So I talked a lot. And so they were always calling my parents saying, hey, Deborah was like, she just really won't shut up. And my mom is like, look, you're not challenging her. Give her something else to do. And then my mother said, well, put her, you know, if you can't give her enough work to do, move her to the next grade. Test her and move her to the next grade. And so I was tested. And so I skipped 6th grade and went straight to 7th grade. And in elementary school, no problem. High school, I loved high school. That's the other reason I'm here. I loved high school. And I want, when I was hearing from people about what the experiences of students on the margin may be like here, that broke my heart. Like school, because I know, I've run into people who went to St. Ignatius who loved it here. They have nothing bad to say about the place, right? I want all of our alumni to have that experience, regardless of where they sit on the spectrum. I want that to be the experience, because I loved high school. All of it but the fact that I couldn't date or drive. I couldn't do either one of those things because my parents were like, you can't, it was certainly, I couldn't drive until I was 16 anyway. And so I turned 16 November of my senior year. And so you can't date until then and you can't drive until you're 16. So a lot of my friends were like going to parties and all that kind of stuff. And my parents were like, yeah, sorry.
Not even prom?
I did go to prom, but I couldn't go my junior year. My mother would not let me go. Someone asked me to go. My junior year, my mother was like, no, she cannot go. You're not 16. And of course I cried, you know, Everett, the tears meant nothing to that lady. So I turned 16 in my senior year and then it was a blast anyway. I loved it. I played basketball in high school. I went to Trotwood Madison High School for a very long time. I also ran track there. I was the shot put and disc champion for a long time. I had the school record for a long time. So it was great. I did those things and, you know, I was in the Spanish club and cooking club and did all that kind of stuff. Got all of my engagement in school. And then I graduated and I went on to play basketball at Winston-Salem State. And that was a great experience too. Not really where I wanted to go. I wanted to go to Marquette, got into Marquette. Wanted to go there, and my mom said no. She really is a buzzkill. Tell her that if you ever see her. Tell her that she's a buzzkill. And she'll crack up laughing. Because I was 16, my dad was the head football coach at my undergraduate institution. And my mother said, you're too young to go off to Marquette, so go to Winston-Salem State for a year, and then next year you can transfer. And I went. And I was on a basketball scholarship, and I absolutely loved it. I pledged my sorority there, so I'm a member of Delta Sigma Theta Incorporated. I pledged my sorority there, and I had great mentors there, and I was challenged academically there. And then after my first year, my mother said, are you going to reapply to Marquette? And I was like, heck no. Like, I love it here. So that's kind of how I ended up there. But I talked a lot. But I mean, that's probably not surprising. I talk all the time because I love talking to people.
Would you mind explaining a little bit about sororities for any students that are might not be in the loop about that and your experience with yours?
Oh, it was fantastic. So I belong to what they call the Divine Nine. So there are nine African-American, and they're diverse, right? But they were started at African-American institutions. They are racially diverse. So I have white sorority sisters and Latino sorority sisters. And so they are civic organizations. They do community service projects. And so my particular organization, again, Delta Sigma Theta Incorporated, is committed to public service. And so we do a lot. We did a lot around voting this year. We do things around education. We have a mentoring program. We also have a Delta debutante ball, which is kind of a coming out ball for young ladies who are in high school. So we have a debutante ball. We do a lot in the community around domestic violence with single moms, teenage moms. And so they really are kind of public service organizations. And there are a variety of them. So there are ones for females, sororities, and then there are ones certainly for males. But they all have a community service commitment.
Mm-hmm. So just to add on, my parents have always been pushy about fraternities in my case, since I'm a male.
Uh-huh.
They didn't partake in them, but they really want me to go to one.
I can see that.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, when I get to college, I think I'll see how my first year goes, and if I really do find myself interested, then I'll go. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
So most of the Divine Nine will not allow you. They call it pledging. They won't allow you to pledge your freshman year because they want you to get in and they want you to get settled and academically sound. So you can then pledge from your sophomore to your senior year. We also have graduate chapters. And so if you decide while you're in college that you don't want to do it, after you graduate, there's always a graduate chapter that you can join. And I'll tell you, so I belong to a black sorority. My son, who went to OU, belongs to, he's going to kill me because I can't remember the name of it. I'll look it up. Nathan is going to kill me. but he did not join a black fraternity. He joined what would typically be known as a white fraternity, right? And so there are also quite a few of those out there. Lambda Chi Alpha. That's it. Nathan, mm-hmm. I got a shout. Mommy gave you a shout out. and it was actually, it really is the group of guys that he kind of bonded with when he got there. And it really, it's just a brotherhood, right? And mm-hmm. it doesn't really matter when people love you, what color your brother is. And so he was there and he met some guys on his floor. His RA belonged to this fraternity, Lambda Chi Alpha, and they were doing a pumpkin roll or something for Halloween. And so he invited him to a pumpkin roll and bowling kind of thing with some pumpkins or something. And he developed friends with them. And then when it was time to consider it, he reached out and said, hey, you know, what would you, you know, I know you belong to a black sorority, and Ohio University has black fraternities. What would you think about me joining this one? And I said, what do you think about you joining that one? And he said, well, I made some friends and they're really cool. In Athens, the school is pretty much kind of the city. It's like it is really the huge employment base for the town. And so the town doesn't necessarily have a lot of resources. And he said, I really appreciate what they stand for. And I said, what kind of things are they doing? And he said, well, they're working with poverty. And then so they have food drives and they have clothing drives for people who live in Athens. And I said, if that's what you're interested in, then that's what you need to do. Like, I'm not going to pick you. I didn't pick your college. I'm not going to pick your fraternity. I'm not going to pick your partner. I need you to go where you feel God is leading you. And if your heart says that this fraternity, regardless of the fact that the majority of your fraternity brothers are white, if what it is saying, if what God is saying to you is they are doing something you believe in, I have to support that, you know. So there's opportunities, you know, to join, you know. You just have to kind of do your research and see what kind of public service commitment they have.
And speaking of college, I'm told that you're a fourth generation college student.
I am.
I was wondering, like, compared to most African Americans, because I believe like 40% of African Americans are first generation. What's the difference between you and one of those first generation? Because I'll be second generation, but like, there's a lot less fourth generation African Americans in the country.
You know, it is a blessing for my family, and it is not one that I take lightly. And that is, it's why I'm committed to education. It's why I am, because I know I've been so blessed in my life, like hands down. There's no question that I have been blessed. My family has been blessed. And I will say that the difference certainly is, could potentially be resources, could potentially be, and I keep saying potentially, because there are people who don't go to college who make very good livings for their family, right? Mm-hmm. It could potentially be expectation around education, right? So I think, and so my children now, you know, are fifth generation. And in our house, it was never, are you going to college? It was where. It was just the expectation. And I envision that it will be the expectation for you and your children.
Definitely.
You know, and let me share a funny story with you that shows you how deep that goes. When Monet was in second or third grade, I'm working at Case Western, and the principal of her elementary school calls and says, hey, like, you know, we need to talk to you. Can you come in? And I'm wondering, like, what's going on? Why do they want to talk to me? But sure, we'd like to talk to you about Monet. And I said, okay. So I go in, and Monet is in second grade, and I was divorced, so I was a single mom. And so I'm like, what, you know, why do they want to talk to me? Like, what's going on? So I get there, and they start asking me, like, you know, so, you know, how do you like Ohio and all this other kind of stuff? I kind of like Ohio. I grew up in Ohio. I'm not from this area, but I like Ohio. I'm 3 hours closer to family, and that's great. And, you know, well, you know, tell us a little bit about your home.
Oh, man.
Right? So this is where those stereotypes and how things often from people of color start to feel a little uneasy, right? I will tell you, even though I'm a fourth generation college student, I get followed around in the grocery store like your mom, who's first generation, right? Because you said you're second, right?
Yes.
I get followed around like your mom. I get followed around like your dad, right? And I'm thinking, where the heck is this going? Like, why do you want to know what's happening in my house? So, you know, what's going on in your home? Are you dating anyone? I'm like, whoa, this is starting to get real personal. Like, what's happening here? And I said, hey, just tell me what you want. Why? What do you want? And they said, well, Monet has been asking different, like, little girls in her class if they want to live with her. And I said, okay, that could potentially, like, mean she has a good home. Like, you know, help me understand. Well, she keeps talking about an apartment or living with them. And I said, well, did you, I don't know. There's nothing going on in my home. And while it's none of your business, I'm not dating anyone, right? Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, why don't you just, well, do we have your permission to ask Monet? So now I'm there, and the principal's there, the school social worker's there. I'm like, okay, you know, I'm like, sure. And they said, well, can we ask her? We don't mind if you are able to hear, but we'd rather have a conversation with her without you in the room.
Been very vague.
That's what I was thinking. So I said, sure, you know, I don't have anything to hide, right? So they call Monet in. And I'm like, hey, Monet, how you doing? And she's like, oh, good. And she's going on and on. You know, how's your relationship with your mommy? And I'm like, where is this going? You're right. What second grader that you make eat her vegetables and go to bed? And she's like, oh, I love my mommy. She's going through that whole thing. You know, does your mommy have a boyfriend? And she was like, no, I have a daddy, right? Because even though my husband and my ex-husband and I were divorced, we were still really good parents, right? No, I have a daddy, right? She's like, no, I was not dating. I got a daddy. Like, why would she do that? And so they're asked, so they talked to her for about 10 minutes and they go on through this whole questioning and they come back to me. And I said, why didn't you ask her what you really wanted to know? Like, why is she asking people to live with her? Mm-hmm. So I said, just invite her in and I'll ask her. And so she comes in the room and I said, Monet, she's like, yes, mommy. And I was like, well, you ask so-and-so, you know, if she wanted to live with you or be your roommate, like, what is that about? You know, what were you thinking? And she says, oh, well, when I go to college, I want her to be my roommate.
I don't know what they were thinking.
Right. And they're right. And so she's like, I really like her. She's my friend. And they were in Girl Scouts together. They were brownies, I think, at that point. She's my friend. Right. And they're thinking, here's this kid, this black kid. Right. Because my kids grew up in Shaker. And this, she's asking little white girls and little black girls, do you want to be my roommate? Do you want to live with me? We can get an apartment or right? Because she didn't have the language for dorm, but it was like an apartment to her because we lived in a house and my children grew up on college campuses. From the moment they were able to walk, they were just on college campus. So she didn't have the language for dorm. So it was like an apartment to her because we knew people who lived in an apartment mm-hmm. and this was like an apartment. And that's why she was saying, do you want to live in the apartment with me? But that's what they thought. And so to your question, there's this expectation. You grow up around college. You understand the importance of education. And I say to my children, whether you ever use it or not, it is yours. Right. And you know, when I was in graduate school, one of the things that I noticed is that we often find ways to be divisive, right? And ways to discriminate against people. And sometimes it's, you know, it's names, and there's a lot of research out there, and I got a whole story about the naming of my children and why I elected to go that way, right? So in graduate school, we'd be doing this resume review. We were talking about institutional racism. And we were looking, and they asked us to, like, but according to the name, is this person African-American? Is this person this? Is this person that? And we're separating. Is this a male? Is Tracy a male or a woman? Is Lynn a man or a woman? And so in that moment, I really started to understand what institutional racism looks like, an unconscious bias, right? So, you know, it's, you know, when I think about it, it's like, you know, you position yourself and your children so that they have opportunities. And that's really what this educational piece is about. It's about you acquiring something that no one can take from you. If you need a bachelor's degree for it, now you have one. If you have a master's degree for it, now you have one, right? But at the end of the day, you know, my goal has always been, which is why my children are in film, find what makes your heart happy and figure out a way to get that to feed you. And I tell my children, I don't care how much money you do or don't make, as long as you can feed you, as you can take care of yourself, right? Certainly people need resources to eat, but at the end of the day, are you a good person? And do you have integrity? And are you honest? And are you reliable? Are you dependable? Are you kind? And do you have the courage to step out for the things you believe? And so I think the difference that I have found is that being a fourth generation a college student has positioned me to have resources that give me some flexibility. And with that commitment to education, then it also opens other doors for me, right? There are a lot of DEI practitioners in the area, but not many who have doctorate degrees. So there are times when colleges will reach out because they're looking for a DEI person and say, hey, we're interested in you, right? Because the you know, the qualifications, we're looking for someone with a doctorate, and there aren't just aren't many people in the area. So it also provides opportunity for you, right? And I think that that's important. You know, you want as many opportunities in life as you can afford yourself. So it is absolutely a blessing. I do not take it lightly. I thank my parents every day for the life that I've had and the one that I'm able to provide for my children. I used to thank my grandmother, passed away 2 years ago, but my grandmother went to college and she in Dayton was one of the first female business owners. So she owned her own beauty shop, which was a very interesting growing up. And so she had a business degree and she opened up a beauty shop, and then she went and got a cosmetology license. And my grandmother started me in Black history, because before she would do my hair, I had to tell her, I had to do a whole report on Madam C.J. Walker. And I was like, really? A book report just to get my hair done? Can I just pay you money? You know? And she was like, no, you need to understand history. You need to understand who you are.
Pay you in knowledge.
You need to pay in knowledge. And so, you know, but one day your children will be in that same position. And, you know, it's a blessing. It is absolutely a blessing, but education is important. And in fact, in my house, if you didn't go to school, you didn't go to church, you couldn't do anything else. That's it. If you're too sick to go to school, you certainly can't go out and play in the snow. You know, if you're too sick to go to church, you certainly can't go roller skating, right? And so I didn't miss either one of those things because I knew I wanted to be out. So education and religion were so important in my family, and that's the way that I have tried to raise my children.
Well, going back to our school, do you see any cultural, social, or systemic issues that really seem like on your top priority right now?
Yeah, right now I'd say my top priority is increasing our level of cultural competence, right? We have got, you know, when I first started, I said to Father Gia within about maybe 30 days, I said, you know, our greatest challenge is that we lack cultural competency. Like, we don't know a lot about how to connect the dots as it relates to other cultures. And so, all very knowledgeable, right? Probably one of you know, certainly with our Cura personalis commitment, one of the most giving kind of environments that I have worked in. And I often say to Father, like, our greatest gift is also, you know, our greatest challenge. Like, when you are truly in community with people, then, you know, sometimes decisions are difficult, right? There are decisions that we make here that take some time. And I have come to appreciate that reflection and the impact the decisions will have on our community. I've come to appreciate that. There are decisions that we make here that take some time that in corporate America we would have made in 2 days and we would have just moved on, right? But what I'm finding here is that I have grown so much as an individual as a result of my commitment to not only engaging the community in the work, but explicitly tying my work to the mission, explicitly tying it to the gospel. When I first started, I said, you know, I asked Father Gale's been, he has been marvelous. Mm-hmm. Because he allows me to just ask him all kind of stuff that I know sometimes he's like, you know, this lady's off her rocker, right? But I said to him, I said, you know, he's giving me all this, and you see all this stuff in my office and all these books, and people have been just so generous, and because I'm not Catholic, helping me understand Catholicism and cura personalis and mission and, you know, Catholic social teaching, and like I got all this stuff and it's all in my head. And I said to him, like, I get it, right? Like, mm-hmm. I understand the theory of all of this. But, like, in some ways it seems so, like, archaic to me. Like, what makes Jesuit education relevant in the 21st century? Like, I don't see a lot that connects this, right? And he was like, nope, just keep reading. You'll get it. You'll understand it. You'll understand it. And then, you know, I came here because I believed in the mission. But what I really came to understand is I believed in the words of the mission. I have come to understand the mission. I've come to understand grad, because they are flowery, fantastic words, right? On the surface. And certainly, you know, someone reads them and they're like, yeah, you know what? I could do this. I could buy into this. This is what I'm looking for. But to truly begin to understand it and embody it is so very different. Like, faith formation sounded like, you know, I got fourth faith formation at my church, right? But to be surrounded by it every day and to have this expectation that every adult that you interact with is pouring into that, I was like, oh my gosh, like this is amazing. But I wonder if Everett and students who look and identify like Everett, if what we are trying to do really resonates with those students, because their culture is different, right?
Yeah.
And then I realized that part of our challenge may be, and I'm getting ready to start the research on this, part of the challenge sometimes with embracing other cultures may be our commitment to, we are all created in the image of God. So if we're all created in the image of God, then there is absolutely no reason to treat you different, because we're all brothers and sisters. And so, but the cultural nuances are so very different for how people of color and women and people who belong to the LGBT community and people who have different degrees of abilities, how they move in the world is so different. And so there's not one framework. And so while we've got a really good and a solid framework, right now that framework, I can't lay that framework on you because your experience is different. And so part of what I'm doing is saying, hey, you know what? I just figured out in my mind, and I appreciate Father Giao for letting me, because he could have just told me the answer, figure this out on my own. What makes Jesuit education relevant in the 21st century is our true commitment to faith that does justice, right? To that commitment to social justice that is active, right? It is that commitment to DEI. It is I started with why I took this job, but I wasn't able to connect the dots since I've been here. That is what makes this a very special place. And now when I talk to people, right, it's all of our students aren't rich. And I share that with people, right? I ask you for adjectives. You do not know us at all. At all. We're all not rich. We're all not white. We're all not male. We're certainly not racist, right? Now, do we operate within a systemically racist system that was established by people long before any of us arrived here? Absolutely, right? Because that's embedded in the system. And now what makes us, what makes the education that we are giving you here relevant is we're asking you to question that system. Mm-hmm. Is it really equitable? Right? Life is not fair, Everett. You know that, right? I'm not asking for equality, because you can't give, everyone doesn't need the same thing, right? I don't know how tall you are, but I'm 6 feet tall. If we're standing in front of a fence and I can see over and you can't, equality means someone get, oh, we see Everett needs a box. Let us give Everett a box. So we want to be fair. So we'll give both of them a box. Now we give you a box, but that box still doesn't allow you to see over the fence. Mm-hmm. I have the same box. And now not only can I see over the fence, but I can see what's happening in the yard beyond this, right? We're talking about equity. I don't need a box. Give Everett two boxes, right? And so, you know, what keeps us relevant is our commitment to social justice and how we live it out. It's the examination of systems that have historically been not equitable, right? And are rooted in racism. And so we just operate. We aren't even thinking about it. We just do it this way because we've always done it this way, right? But
if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
If it's not broke, look at our alumni. They are fantastic. They are successful. Look at the number of people, faculty and staff, who are clamoring to work here. We post a position, we get hundreds of applications, right? Because they know. So if we're getting hundreds of applicants, why should we care about diversity, right? Well, if you only, again, remember I mentioned that kind of archaic perspective. If you only think about diversity as it relates to gender and race, then you don't see any value in it. But if you think about age, right? If you think about the wisdom that comes with a tenured faculty member here and a new faculty member, right? If you think about socioeconomic differences and the conversations that someone who has resources can have with someone who doesn't have resources, if you think about the networking opportunities that happen here, I mean, it's those are the things, those opportunities to make sure that we are putting the best person in front of you every day, all day, right? And I've been on search committees and I've said, you know, there have been people of color who have applied. And, you know, I think, although my colleagues haven't said this, the first round that I was involved in, I know they thought, okay, if it's a person of color, she's going to, like, push for them. She's going to push. She wants the black woman. She wants the black man. And I was on a search committee when I was like, no, that's not the person. Because I want the best for you. If it's an alumni, if it's a white man, if it's a white woman, if it's a Latino woman, if it's an Asian American, I don't care. I want the best for you. And as we do this work and we think about equity in hiring, all I want to do is provide a robust applicant pool so that when Mr. Sable is looking for his math teacher, when he says, this is the person, he knows that is the person. Because we had the best in the applicant pool and we picked the best person. You didn't automatically give me the math teacher job because you like me and I can do basic addition, right? He's got the best person. And as a committee, you know, my second and third rounds at this, we are having really rich conversation, right? We want the person to have content expertise, but how is this person going to form Everett? How is this person going to move in this space? Is this person going to be a good colleague, right? Does this person believe what we believe? And so, you know, that's what excites me every day, is the opportunity to come in and to work on our level of cultural competence and to help us understand why, yes, we are all brothers and sisters in Christ and we are all created in the image of God, but we all don't move in the world the same way. And you, person who is in the dominant culture, and often people get nervous when I say dominant because they automatically think white, right? But here, you know, male is also the dominant culture. Catholic is also the dominant culture. So I also want to help people understand the multiple cultures that they belong to. And as a result of that, how you make decisions, how you interact with students. So it's, I've learned a lot, but right now, cultural competence is top of mind for me consistently. I need us to understand that we are different and we're unique and it's okay, right? Difference is not a bad thing. And actually, you know, in the corporate world, like, you know, the companies who understand diversity. And the first time I said this to a CEO, it just like kind of blew his mind. Diversity is not black and white. It's green. It is green. And the companies that understand and value diversity, they outperform their competitors head over heels because they have diverse people at the table and they have multiple perspectives at the table. And so as they are looking to create a product, now they are not just getting the cookie cutter Dr. Richardson Phillips perspective. They're asking, you know, people from different generations. They're asking men, they're asking women, they're asking people who are racially different. They're asking people who geographically live in different, you know, areas. Like what's going to appeal in, I live in Mentor. What's gonna appeal in Mentor? What's gonna appeal in Westlake, right? You've got all of that richness at the table.
Diverse idea rather than just a bunch of different races, just genuine diverse thought
and
experience.
And when that happens, you create a safe space. And I'm a person who believes people can only learn when they can feel vulnerable enough and transparent enough to tell you they don't know. And if you think about a class that you were in, and maybe you were a little uncertain about whether you should speak up or not, right? You had a question, you know, or you didn't want to seem like, you know, you didn't want to, you know, make your professor think you didn't do the work. You certainly didn't want your classmates maybe to know you didn't know, so you didn't ask a question. Right, when you're in a classroom that uses inclusive pedagogy and, you know, and communicates and with students, you know, in a way that's cross-cultural, right, that uses material that's inclusive, right, all students get a chance to engage, and now everyone gets a chance to say they don't know. So Mr. Sable puts out a math question, and you know, I got the addition, and I got the algebra. He starts moving into trig and geometry. He's kind of on his own, right? If he hasn't created a safe space for me to raise my hand and say, hey, I don't know, if he hasn't taken the time to build a genuine relationship with me, I'm not going to go visit him during his office hours. I'm going to try to figure it out myself, and I'm going to pray I get it right. But I'm not going to let him or my colleagues know I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so that's what cultural competency is about. It is about creating the kind of space that we all desire. And I honestly believe this. The kind of space we all desire all of our students to have. And so I'm gonna deal with that, you know. Folks have, you know, asked me, you know, what are we doing about racism and anti-racism and you know, when are we going to address that? And we'll get to that. You know, the stuff that we are doing
is a bigger issue.
And actually, you know, if it's anti-racism work, it's dismantling, right, the parts of our culture that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And often it's difficult for people to do anti-racism work because they immediately think that I'm calling them racist. And those are two different concepts, right? And so as a community, as we begin to really get our arms around that, the difference, you can operate in a racist system and be engaged in behaviors that often are associated with racism unintentionally. That's where there's a lot of work out there about unconscious bias, because you're doing it and you don't even know you're doing it, right? Mm-hmm. But first we've got to create a safe space for the experts, right? So our faculty, they're the experts at what they do. And I've been in this position. It's hard to be the expert and also be the novice. So I know everything about DEI, but I'm still learning this whole Catholic thing, right? I'm still learning that, right? And it's a balance. And which is why, you know, I appreciate this community. They've been so very patient with me. They've allowed me to ask questions. They've given me all types of things to read. Father Remus spent a lot of time with me. Certainly Father Guillao, people from the JSN have been, the Jesuit School Network, have all been so very helpful and serving as mentors and allowing me to ask the question. And that, the space that they have intentionally created for me, right? And certainly, you know, there are people who will say, well, certainly you're a vice president. They're going to do everything they can to make you feel comfortable because of where you sit on the hierarchy, right? And for some people, that may be true. They may believe that that's why this is happening. But I honestly believe it's because there's a genuine commitment. And they've created the space, a safe space for me to say, I don't know. And that's the space that we all working for you and all the other students who are here and the students who will come behind you. Have we always gotten it right? Absolutely not. We have not. And we are positioning ourselves to acknowledge when there's a situation, to own our part in it, and then to do whatever we can to make people whole. That's that cultural confidence piece. How do I, you know, can I ever say to a student, whatever you experienced will absolutely never happen on this campus again? I can't promise you that. But what I can say is we are committed to making you whole when something happens. And then figuring out how do we increase the likelihood of it not happening again? And that's through education. That's through education. And what better to learn than an educational institution? So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's what I'm working on now. I'm working on cultural competence. And once you understand that you belong to multiple cultures, you know, it's easier, I think, to do that. And I make myself very, very vulnerable in that space. And I tell people I don't get this. And so if she can say she doesn't get this, right? And it's not about doing my job. I'm not asking you to say that you're incompetent at what we hired you to do. I'm asking you to say, be willing to say there's more I can learn about other things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, just one last question. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Again, I'll say I'm so honored to serve as your Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. I'm so very blessed to be here. I'm humbled by the reception that I've received from the community. And there have been some, certainly we've had some hiccups. Mm-hmm. That's life. That's the way it works. I'm asking people as we do this work to extend one another some grace, right? The same grace that God extends to us every day, knowing that we're going to have challenges and we're going to misstep, right? Extend some grace, develop some genuine relationships, step outside of your comfort zone. This is a safe place to do that. There's a safety net called community here. We're only going to let you fall so far, right? If you have any questions, you or the listeners or any of my colleagues, I am certainly here. I will make myself available. This is my first podcast. I'm so excited. My kids were so excited. So I told my son, I said, they reached out to me. I'm going to do a podcast. I'm working on my speech. He's like, no, Mom, you don't need a speech. No, Mom, it really is a conversation. And my husband's like, oh, well, you got that because you can talk. You can talk all day. So I'm so honored that you asked me, and certainly open to doing it whenever you'd like to have me back.
All right. Well, thank you for your work here at Ignatia so far. I think a lot will change the more you'll be here. And even though it'll be a college, I bet like if I return after college, it'll just be a whole new place because of you. So I'm glad that your presence here will give me that comfort.
Well, thank you. And mm-hmm. not if you return, when you return, because yeah. we're bringing you back as an active alumni. And while I appreciate that, this is our work. And I am only as successful as our community allows me to be. So this is our work. And certainly when you come back, I want you to be proud of us. Mm-hmm. I want you to be proud of who we are in that moment. We'll always have work to do, but I think we have a commitment to keep striving to be the best we can be and provide the best experience. So thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. Dr. Richardson Phillips, I'm Everett Allen Hood, and this has been The Melting Pot.